Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. And next up, we have the wild similarities between the show Yellowstone and real life in the Mountain West. From power struggle over land to the ultra-wealthy pushing out locals, some parts of the hit TV show, which just premiered as the second half of its fifth season, aren't that far from the truth. It's by Riley Nusili. I started watching the hugely popular TV series Yellowstone in 2020, during the height of the COVID pandemic. By then, there were multiple seasons available, and my husband and I had nothing but time. We were hooked. We're not the only ones. The second half of Season 5, which came out on November 11th, saw more than 16 million viewers. Only NFL football had more TV viewers than Yellowstone last season. Character names like Rip and Dutton have seen exponential increase in their use for newborn babies. And as the New York Times recently reported, Americans really want their own piece of the Yellowstone landscape, and the show may be partly to blame. Which got me thinking, how much of the show is based in reality? And is it really affecting what's happening in the West? The show is over-the-top melodrama, but writer and co-creator Taylor Sheridan obviously chose real-life conflicts in Montana and other Western states to base the plot on. Here are four ways the show bears more resemblance to reality than a casual fan might realize. Number one, the series suggests big developers will stop at nothing to broker land deals. That may be true. In Yellowstone, the Duttons are constantly navigating nefarious plots to seize their ranch by out-of-state land development interests. Some, it seems, will stop at nothing to dispossess the family in order to capitalize on the value of their land, creating ridiculously violent scenes. In real life, there's example after example of complicated land deals in Montana and the West in which developments for the wealthy take up premier land. The Yellowstone Club, which is just north of Yellowstone National Park in Big Sky, Montana, has been a bastion for the ultra-wealthy since it's opened in the late 90s. Boasting private powder and ruthlessly protected privacy for its members, among other features, the club was created through a series of land swaps with the Forest Service, which turned a checkerboard of public and private land into consolidated acreage for the club's founder, Tim Blixeth. While the Yellowstone Club is already controversial among Montanans, few of whom can afford the steep cost of membership, which involve a $300,000 deposit, annual club dues of $36,000, and annually property owners association dues of $10,000. It's also trying to expand into a contentious area of the Crazy Mountains. As Ben Ryder Howe reported in New York Magazine's Intelligencer, a group of billionaires associated with the club has been maneuvering to privatize contested swaths of land that yield access to the crazies for some time. The Forest Service, ranchers, the Native Crow, the general public, and the Yellowstone Club all seem to have a stake in the outcome. 2. Places like Bozeman, Montana really are becoming overrun with furs and fancy cars. I know folks who live in Bozeman. I've read plenty of the reporting we've done here at Outside and elsewhere related to life in mountain towns like Bozeman, where affordable housing shortages, the aftermath of a global pandemic, remote work, and the glamorization of mountain lifestyles have created a rich broth of income inequality that is apparent as you navigate the city. Right in 2022 for Outside, Maggie Slipian, who has been based in Bozeman for more than a decade, noted the visual changes on the town and the landscape that were being wrought by the influx of new, wealthy, second home residents. Watching Yellowstone, some of the fashions my beloved Beth Dutton opted for on her runs to town struck me as a bit much even for her unparalleled character. Silky sheaths beneath a luxe full-length fur coat, anyone? Sartorial considerations aside, affordability remains a major issue, and Yellowstone focuses primarily on the more glamorous troubles a family that owns the largest ranch in the area would face, not on persons being priced out of their apartment or the family acknowledging that they'll never be able to swing it for a single-family home. Number 3. The Duttons struggled to afford the ranch. So do many real families. In the years since Yellowstone premiered, a number of outlets have interviewed real generational ranchers in Montana to get a sense of their view of the show. The dynamics among the family itself often get highlighted as one of the most believable elements. In an interview with Variety from 2023, a third-generation rancher from Idaho, Jesse Jarvis, highlights the familial dysfunction as one of the most realistic elements of the show. The Duttons' interpersonal conflicts are largely driven by the struggle to afford their 700,000-acre ranch. In real life, the total number of farms and ranches in Montana is down 10.3% from 2017, according to U.S. Census data from 2022. And with continued interest from developers to obtain large tracts of land in the area, it seems likely land and home prices will continue to rise. Recent data from the USDA Summary of Land Values indicates a consistent increase of cropland value in Montana from 2012 on. And this is to say nothing of the capital needed to operate a large-scale ranch. Number 4. Indigenous land is being acquired and compromised by development. Fans of Yellowstone see complex dynamics of power and history at play in the dealings of the Duttons and others with the fictional Broken Rock Indian tribe. As the screw twists and turns, the broken rot led on the show by Chairman Thomas Rainwater find themselves on both the dealing and receiving ends of bad land deals and villainous behavior from local and out-of-state actors. This contemporary dispossession of indigenous people fits into the long and violent history in which legal and extra-legal measures are taken by those in power to forcibly remove indigenous inhabitants from their land. To cite a real example, you can look again to Crazy Mountains in Montana. The Crazies are filled with significant and sacred sites for the native Crow. The current proposal for land possession there, private land prevents the Crow from visiting many of these sites without permission from the landowner. Outside's reporting in the Yaak Valley offers another illustrative example of these dynamics. There's likely much more to say about the real power dynamics in the Mountain West and fights for public lands overlap with some of what you see on the small screen in Tyler Sheridan's fantasy universe. As they say, truth can be really stranger than fiction. And that was an article on the show Yellowstone by Riley Nusili, who got a master's degree and half of a PhD in literature and culture from the University of Oregon before leaving to pursue a career in digital media. She loves reading and writing about the intersection of popular media and culture. And next up, we have in Montana, a threatened swath of old growth fuels a long-standing debate. In the remote, heavily logged Yaak Valley, an unlikely stand of old growth sits at the center of debate about what forest is for and how best to protect it. It's by Laura Yale. When Rick Bass first found himself in the area referred to as Unit 72 by the United States Forest Service, he felt desperate and unanchored. He was walking up what was once an overgrown logging road but had recently been clear-cut into a 200-foot-wide strip of barren land. Roughly 1 million board feet of sellable timber had been removed and only a few of the largest larch remained. The Forest Service had cleared the area as a fire break in response to the Davis Fire, ignited by lightning in July 2018 in the remote, rugged Yaak Valley, which is situated within the Kootenai National Forest in northwest Montana. Blow down lined the edges of the firebreak. The trees, once insulated from the elements, were newly exposed and didn't have the roots to sustain full-force winds. Bass, a 66-year-old rider and conservationist, crossed a thick section of fallen old spruce, balanced himself on the larger trunks. After living in the Yaak Valley for nearly four decades, he's sturdy and no stranger to bushwhacking. Finally, he stepped out of the hot, dry clear cut and through a cool emerald green portal. As far as recorded history could reveal, the forest he was entering, Unit 72, had never been logged. Blanketed with ferns and dripping with moss, the forest looked like it was plucked from the Pacific Northwest and moved 350 miles inland. It's one of the few remaining echoes of an ancient rainforest that tens of millions of years ago spread from the Washington coast into Montana. Grizzlies, lynx, and wolverines sniff and scratch through 800-year-old larch and some of the largest western hemlock, western red cedar, and Engelmann spruce in the valley. The area is one of the only six habitats in the lower 48 states considered large and intact enough to support a grizzly bear population. Relief washed over Bass, then he saw long strips of flagging and blue and orange paint slathered across some of the larger tree trunks. The Forest Service, it seemed, planned to log here too, in the old growth. His first reaction was rage, but he had learned over the years that wrath was not an effective tool in the fight to protect these trees, which were too important to risk. They had survived centuries of wildfire, drought, pests, and logging that decimated other forests in the region. Now they're engulfed in discord, their fate to be decided by humans who can't agree whether to actively manage the area through clear-cutting or to leave it alone. In 2017, U.S. Forest Service staff responsible for the Kootenai National Forest, KNF, proposed a sweeping 95,000-acre forest management plan called the Black Ram Project to improve resilience and resistance to insects, disease, and fire. Unit 72 would be effectively clear-cut. In the words of the KNF supervisors, they would restart the stand to improve the forest's ability to adjust to climate change. This sparked an impassioned battle on the ground and in federal court between environmental advocates, local and federal governments, and other stakeholders. After 7 years of disagreements, Unit 72 has yet to be logged, but hasn't been permanently protected either. With wildfire season becoming longer and more intense across the U.S. and Canada, people are desperate for answers, and the debate of how best to mitigate such fire rages on. Many at the Forest Service and in the timber industry argue that forest clearing projects similar to the Black Ram are the answer, but it's unclear whether these measures, which have gained popularity in the past decade, are always undertaken with a sincere goal of mitigating wildfire. Many conservationists believe that the Forest Service and the timber industry are capitalizing on the public sphere and that painting these projects, many of which include cutting down old growth, as restorative, is merely a convenient way to justify logging. A hefty volume could be filled with the year's worth of court documents, scientific studies, and letters to the editor generated by the different sides of the Black Ram dispute. But let's begin with one thing everyone agreed on, that the Forest Service has mismanaged public forests for more than a century. 100 years of fire suppression and an immense amount of logging have left our forests vulnerable to wildfire, insect infestation, and disease, all of which are compounded by changing climate. There's good research and people on both sides of the Black Ram debate. The more important question is who and what are we protecting these forests for? Rick Bass wasn't always an environmentalist. Before he moved to the Yaak Valley, he was a geologist. Born and raised in Texas, Bass fell in love with the West when he went to Utah for college. He studied geology and wildlife science, and after graduating in 1979, began working for an independent oil and gas prospector in the Southeast, mapping potential drilling sites on private land. He loved that job, required him to become intimately familiar with landscapes, that he could spend his mornings writing before clocking in for the day. At 29, a powerful nostalgia drew him back to the mountains. An avid hunter who enjoyed quiet places, he drove north and then west until he found a place with huge swaths of wilderness and very few people. There, in a small writing cabin on a marsh in the Yaak Valley, he launched his prolific writing career. He was called a literary titan by the New York Times, and his work, which includes fiction, memoir, and essays, often focused on his own backyard. It's an incredibly unique landscape, and it really stimulates your mind, Bass says. The more you learn of it, the more amazed you are by the elegance and complexity, the story of the ecosystem. But while his relationship with the land inspired his writing, it also distracted him from it. When Bass moved to the Yaak in 1987, he quickly realized how aggressively the valley was being logged. Even then, the area felt like the last fall, the last of the last, a fragment of an intact ecosystem. I thought I just needed to write a couple of essays, and this oversight, the lack of any protected areas in the Yaak, would be corrected in short order, he says. He soon became one of the Yaak's leading wilderness activists. In the late 80s, the meetings were toxic, he recalls. People would intentionally intimidate him and dismiss any idea that might be considered conservation-oriented. But his experience hunting and working in an extractive industry gave him some credibility with the locals, because it placed him outside a recognizable environmentalist box. There was some value in the fact that it wasn't just the traditional choir preaching at them, he says. In 1987, logging in the U.S. reached its absolute peak on public lands. For context, 2.9 billion board feet were harvested in national forests in 2023, the most in 25 years. But in 1987, that number was 12.7 billion board feet, an amount most people, even the Forest Service itself, understood was unsustainable. It was enough to lumber to build roughly 800,000 single-family homes. The year 1987 also saw an increase in public environmental outrage, with numerous tree sites, blockades, and protests in Washington, California, and Oregon. Bass was just beginning his advocacy work, and he was unaware of larger efforts to protect forests and old growth. He was simply one of a handful of people who imagined a different future for the Yaak. During those early years of advocacy, he spent countless hours making phone calls, passing out flyers, writing letters to elected officials, and trying to get even just a couple dozen folks to show up for meetings. He would wake up early to write and then get pulled into activism work. When hunting season came around in the fall, he'd retreat into the woods for a few months in search of personal restoration. As Bass writes in the Book of Yaak, published in 1996, there is a rhythm that we must all find in loving and fighting for a place, the integration of advocacy into your other peaceful life. Do not think it will always seem like a balanced or even pleasant rhythm. 37 years have passed since Bass moved to the Yaak. He's now executive director of the Yaak Valley Forest Council, a grassroots nonprofit he and a handful of other locals founded in 1997. Since then, the Yaak Valley Forest Council has repaired and restored many critical riparian habitats in the Yaak with its Headwaters Restoration Project. Conservation education is a key part of the organization's work as well. A real battle has been the slow, intergenerational work of encouraging people to feel comfortable talking about the value of wild country. The Yaak is an incredibly special ecosystem, a place worth protecting not for its recreational or timber values, but for its unique and seething biodiversity, Bass says. Perhaps most importantly, the YVCFC has successfully defended, at least for the short term, thousands of acres of forest. Bass is fluent in science, policy, and law, languages he and others have repeatedly used to try and obtain lasting protection for the Yaak Valley's forest. When the Black Ram proposal came around, Bass thought that perhaps he should try something different. He wanted to bring in people who could be moved by beauty, which is everybody, he says. He'd fight the battle with art. This time he thought maybe he could find a way to amplify the voices of the trees themselves. The Black Ram controversy has all the usual suspects of a big environmental dust-up. Conservationists, native tribes, an industry with something to gain, local and federal governments, and importantly, wildlife. In the Yaak, that includes a recovering grizzly population that biologists have been working to stabilize since the 1980s. Each interest group claims to share the same goal, to protect the forest health. They just can't agree on how to do that. The Forest Service, county commissioners, and the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, which joined a lawsuit in support of the Forest Service and the Black Ram Project, believe this should be active management. Conservationists, on the other hand, consider the forest a resilient ecosystem best protected from intervention. The grizzlies can't speak on their own behalf, of course, but Forest Service documents acknowledge that the project is likely to adversely affect them. The Forest Service active management proposal includes prescribed burns, stream restoration, and thinning in the areas of the forest choked out from clear-cut regrowth gone wrong. After a clear cut, trees can grow back all at once and too close together, leading to a crowded forest of stunted trees. But the Black Ram proposal also includes almost 4,000 acres of commercial harvest, of which 700 to 950 acres are old growth and mature forests. Half of that area, including Unit 72, is slated to be clear cut with reserves, which means that all but approximately 10 to 34 trees per acre would be felled. Herein lies the Forest Service's other objective with the Black Ram project. That felled timber, around 57 million board feet, would likely sell for between $40 million and $60 million at current market prices. For much of the Forest Service history, timber sales have been a significant budgetary source. Since the 1940s, the Forest Service has had strong financial incentives to log. It's an important part of their business model. Thus, for decades, the agency has managed trees like 40-year crop rotations, favoring board feet sold over other management goals such as biodiversity and wildlife resilience. Now, Forest Service Deputy Chief Chris French says that the agency is shifting its focus from economically driven harvest to reducing wildfire risk and creating long-term resiliency. He also stresses that the mitigating wildfires is critical to saving old growth. According to a recent government analysis, since 2000, wildfires have decimated 1,076 square miles of old growth forest nationwide, while logging claimed just under 16 square miles. The trouble is that wildfire mitigation, which most ecologists agree requires both thinning and prescribed burns, costs money. Protecting forests from fire typically involves pre-commercial thinning or harvesting smaller trees that generally can't be sold. But to make money and replenish their budget, the Forest Service needs to do thinning and logging that have commercial potential and harvest bigger trees. We need to leverage the value that's in the forest, which reduces the cost of wildfire mitigation to the American taxpayer, says French. He offers an example. If the Forest Service thinned and burned 1,000 acres without obtaining any sort of timber harvest, it might cost $1,000 per acre. But with timber harvesting part of the equation, the cost could go down to $100 per acre, and the Forest Service could thin 10 times more acreage. This makes sense until you consider the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which authorized the Forest Service to spend billions on forest management. But French says that the newly available money has been difficult to manage. The Forest Service now has the money to operate at a larger scale, but doesn't have the staff or enough available contractors to plan and carry out the work they might now be able to afford. Many national forests are still relying on the old budget paradigms while they wait for new systems to get up and running. Additionally, some members of the Kootenai Tribe of Idaho, like its Attorney General William Barquin, believe that the economic health of the community needs to be considered in tandem with the forest. He explained that the local economy depends on forestry. We have an obligation not only take care of the ecosystem, but to consider that humans are part of that ecosystem, he told me. Tribal Vice Chairman Jerry Aiken Jr. also emphasized this balance. To repair the forest, the whole habitat, sometimes that puts a little bit of pinch on different species, but it's never meant to detriment them, he told me. The tribe is not directly involved in the timber industry, and not all indigenous citizens with ancestral ties to the Yak agree with that stance. Some have spoken out against the Black Ram project. At this point, it's hard to decipher which economic incentives are winning out. This is where a big management project like Black Ram that combines restoration and commercial logging gets sticky. At best, the approach strikes a balance between economic health and the forest's health. At worst, it's a disingenuous way to continue logging old growth in mature forests under the guise of mitigation and restoration. Another wrinkle. In certain cases, fuel reduction projects are given less rigorous, quicker environmental review by the Forest Service. Sometimes this expedited approval is necessary, like when fires threaten dry old growth in sequoias in California. But some environmental groups worry that the Forest Service abuses the more lenient review to log mature and old growth forests. In the case of Black Ram and many other large logging projects, the Forest Service is able to skirt the standard in-depth environmental impact statement, instead use a less rigorous environmental assessment when it approved the project. Well, the Yaak Valley Forest Council, the organization that Bass directs, agrees that a few aspects of the Black Ram project might be helpful, such as prescribed burns. It believes that the logging of old growth and mature forests, along with road building and grizzly habitat, outweigh the theoretical benefits. Beginning in 2022, five groups filed a series of lawsuits against the KNF, arguing that the project would threaten the vulnerable population of grizzly bears and release significant amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. Anthony South stops mid-sentence and tilts his head to listen to a bird call, a pileated woodpecker, perhaps. The ground absorbs the sound of his footsteps as he moves gently over decaying trees covered in moss. South, who grew up in the area, is the headwaters director of the Yaak Valley Forest Council, where he's worked for the past decade. He has lived in the Yaak for most of those 10 years, largely without electricity or running water, and every drainage, mountain, creek, and road is mapped in his mind. When he resumes talking, he explains that Unit 72 isn't designated as old growth by the Forest Service. Standing there, dwarfed by the towering trees, I find this hard to believe, but the KNF has its own definition of old growth. The wording is laid out in a complicated 71-page document that has received few updates since 1992. Under its guidelines, which considers factors including tree size, number of large trees per acre, forest structure, minimum age of trees, and more, the Forest Service says Unit 72 doesn't qualify. Yet two independent forest ecology experts disagree. Herb Hammond of Silva Ecosystem Consultants and Dominic Della Sala, Chief Scientist at Earth Island Institute's Wild Heritage Project, have concluded in separate reports that Unit 72 has significant old-growth characteristics. Della Sala called it a no-brainer that Unit 72 should be classified as old-growth. Critical part of our inability to protect old growth is our inability to define it. No two ecosystems are the same, so there's no single definition that works for all of them. Additionally, what constitutes an old tree varies dramatically among species. Bristlecone pines can live 5,000 years, while cotton ones usually make it just past 100. Some definitions of old growth emphasize lack of disturbance by humans, while others specify minimum age or size, soil moisture, tree density, understory complexity, or slope aspect. Most definitions agree that old growth forests are structurally advanced and have exceptional levels of biodiversity compared with log forests. In 2022, President Biden issued an executive order tasking the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management with establishing standardized definitions for old growth and mature forests and conducting a nationwide inventory. He also proposed prohibiting commercial logging of old growth forests in all 128 of the U.S. national forests. South drops to the ground to admire feathery lichen the size of his head. He explains that the forest is full of shade and water-loving cedar, hemlock, and Engelmann spruce, along with species more tolerant to drought, heat, and sunlight, like western larch and western white pine. The Black Ram Project hopes to repopulate Unit 72 with only the latter and the other drought-tolerant species like Ponderosa. The hope is that the new forest will be more resilient to wildfire and climate change. But as independent report from Della Sala and Hammond point out, the existing forest is moisture-laden, diverse, and old, and as a result is already resilient to fire. Additionally, many scientists argue that mature and old-growth forests are critical refuge in a changing climate. A study conducted in Oregon found that old growth creates cooler microclimates, which can help local flora and fauna cope with rising temperatures. Furthermore, there's a growing body of evidence that older forests store more carbon than young forests do and play a crucial role in staving off climate swings. The Biden administration's unprecedented efforts to protect old growth from logging appease neither side. The American Forest Resource Council, a timber industry trade association, called old growth logging a negligible threat and claimed that Biden administration's effort were a distraction from the wildfire and forest health crisis and would further complicate forest management. Meanwhile, environmental groups pointed out that proposed rules don't protect mature forests, future old growth. As national dialogue whipsawed between opposing views about old growth and wildfire, back in the Yak, a federal judge made a precedent-setting decision about the Black Ram Project. In August 2023, Judge Donald W. Malloy found that the KNF did not accurately account for the cumulative effects of the project, specifically with regard to grizzlies and carbon emissions. In a strongly worded decision, the judge pointed out that KNF was improperly comparing the environmental impact of Black Ram with the massive carbon stocks stored in entire national forests, a comparison that made the significant carbon footprint of Black Ram seem only infinitesimal, as KNF put it. He also concluded that the prevailing logic of most Forest Service logging projects that young trees will eventually grow to store the same amount of carbon once stored in the felled trees is no longer sufficient. In his ruling, Malloy said, logging causes immediate carbon losses while re-sequestration happens slowly over time, that the planet may not have. It's the first time a court has asked the Forest Service in the context of a timber sale to take a hard look at the carbon effects of logging projects, said Christine Ackland, Northern Rockies Director and Senior Attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the conservation groups that sued the Forest Service over the Black Ram Project. The Yaak Valley Forest Council took the court decision as a win. But it was short-lived. In March 2024, the Forest Service appealed the case on process around grizzly bear issues, not on the climate arguments. The Kootenai National Forest appeal on Black Ram is unsurprising from an agency so feckless with its drive to meet board foot targets rather than conserve biodiversity, says Bass. The KNF continues to be in a full flight from best available science on both grizzly bears and the vital importance of old and mature forests in slowing the rate of climate change. It's clear in the rejection of the Biden administration's executive order to protect old and mature forests that the agency is racing to clear-cut Black Ram in the Yaak before the project can be discovered. Notably, Black Ram is only one of five adjacent logging projects in the Yaak, collectively totaling more than 300,000 acres, an area slightly larger than the city of Los Angeles. Three of the projects are already underway, while the Black Ram and Knotty Pine projects remain tied up in court. Black Ram presents a false dichotomy. Bass believes that if the Forest Service did its job well, we wouldn't have to choose between logging and grizzlies or old growth protection and wildfire mitigation. So what's his proposed solution? 7 years after it was first proposed that the Black Ram's forest be clear-cut, Bass' anger has subsided. While he doesn't agree with or trust the Forest Service, he also has some gratitude for them. They were the ones who first alerted him to the forest in Unit 72 after all. While he's currently spending more of his time on activism than on writing, he no longer sees art and activism as opposing forces. He has a calm assuredness of someone who's an integrated, disparate parts of himself. The day I met Bass, he hadn't slept much, been up late the night before getting a guitar lesson from Jeff Bridges. Yes, the dude. Bass' instrument of choice is dark amber, emblazoned with grizzly prints that saunter up his neck. He had it made from wood from one of the fallen spruces at the edge of Unit 72 firebreak. It's breathtaking, both visually and acoustically. It's fast, light, hot, bright, yet also deeply rich and low, says Bass. He calls it the Black Ram Guitar. The instrument is now on its own national tour and has been played by local and famous musicians alike, including the singer Maggie Rogers, who call attention to the act and the pressure it faces when they perform. Bridges has become the ambassador for Force and is helping create an additional line of Black Ram guitars that will debut this fall and also travel the country. The project is part of Bass's attempt to accomplish conservation through cultural change. Instead of simply shaking their fingers, the YVFC wants to cultivate celebration and creation. We're making a compelling and beautiful case, our best case, about why this forest is worth preserving and learning from. To achieve this goal, the YVFC began crafting a proposal to create the nation's first climate refuge, which would include C-Unit 72, but expand well beyond it. The Kootenai National Forest, which makes up just over 2% of Montana's land base, holds 25% of its listed sensitive species. How can you not use the word refuge, Bass asks? The YVFC has begun community outreach about what the first climate refuge could look like, consulting residents, scientists, educators, land managers, and the Refugia Research Coalition, a group dedicated to accelerating science and management of climate change, Refugia. In the long term, Bass envisions designating and protecting more old and mature forests as refugees along the Canadian border, stringing together a necklace of living, porous, protected areas managed specifically for biodiversity, carbon storage, and animal migration. While the group doesn't yet know what management will look like, it does know one thing. There would be no commercial logging. It also firmly believes that the refuge should harmonize science and policy with art and education. It has brought artists into the area, including U.S. poet laureate Ada Limon, who wrote a poem about Unit 72 after visiting the area and learning about the Black Ram proposal. For Bass, the key to a better future is imagination, not just human ingenuity. These ideas, do they come from us? Do they come from the landscape? Do they come from a relationship between us and the landscape? I would suggest the latter, he says. It's not just this person or this person's idea. It's a relationship between species. And that was an article on the Ram in Montana. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.